Hey, this is Sean P. the Ghost Man.
And this is Nathan S., a.k.a. the Demon Hunter.
And all you blue-collar ghost hunters need to be sure to tune in and listen live every Sunday night from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m.
Right here on Blog Talk Radio.
Where we'll be discussing ghost hunting and all the folks who do it.
You can check us out at www.ghostanddemon.com.
And believe us when we say this ain't your mama's paranormal, baby.
Ghost Man and Demon Hunter is beyond the normal podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Something paranormal, and it's not you. never been seen before, and it's going to show itself soon. Get ready for the paranormal experience you've been waiting for. Coming 2007, the ultimate paranormal community. Parahosa. Spirits and hauntings, cryptozoology, UFO, ancient mysteries, all things paranormal. Parahosa. Online paranormal community. Live national ghost hunts. Ultimate paranormal community.
Coming soon at para-palooza.com.
You are listening to Ghostly Talk with your hosts Doug and Scott L.
The technical issues have been solved.
Well, maybe.
We're going to monitor the situation, but yeah. We believe that we have a good start to an absolutely excellent guest. A lot of people know that one of my personal things that I like to read about, my personal interests, are physical mediumship. So, let's talk to...
God, this is, like, good, Doug.
Thank you.
Rosemarie.
Yes, let's talk to Rosemarie Pilkington, who has been interested in psychic phenomena since childhood when she heard family stories of unexplained visions and happenings. As a young adult, she immersed herself in articles, books, and journals on the subject and attended seminars and lectures sponsored by the ASPR, the American Society for Psychical Research. In her new book, The Spirit of Dr. Bindeloff, Rosemarie focuses on one little-known episode of physical mediumship. There's the tie-in, something that I really like. Gilbert Roller's utterly charming and disarming autobiographical account of a group of teenagers who experimented with seance phenomena. Ooh, big no-no from everybody I talked to. And contacted an alleged spirit named Dr. Bindeloff. Without further ado, everybody, fire up your browsers and go to www.rspiritsreal.com. That's three words, all run together with no spaces. Mm-hmm. A-R-E, Spirits Real, R-E-A-L, .com. And welcome Rosemarie Pilkington to Ghostly Talk.
How are you doing tonight, Rosemarie?
I'm very happy to be here. It's snowing outside, but I'm nice and comfortable in here.
We're having ice.
We got
tonight.
Ice storms tonight.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Yeah,
we're having complete ice tonight. We're trying to get through all the attendant technical issues that brings to doing a show in an ice storm.
Yeah, exactly.
We're in the Detroit area, so we are under a complete sheet of ice.
Yeah, it's always a lot of fun.
It's so good to talk to you, Rosemarie, because one of the things that we don't talk about enough that doesn't get talked about, I go to conferences a lot, and you know, we're all out there looking for EVPs, and we're looking for to get a photograph of a vortex or of a full figure apparition, or
that's
even
really
a
good
hand or a pinky would do. But
yeah.
But we're really looking for these things. And we're also experiencing, you know, the things through mental mediums. You know, on TV, there's mental mediums. I know.
And there are many good mental mediums.
Yes, and I know umpteen numbers of them, and each of them are fascinating, and they bring a lot of mysterious knowledge. I mean, I don't know how they get it. You know, it's that's all the stuff about why it's so interesting, is that I don't know how they know the things they know. But it's mental mediumship. I read these other books. I read these books about the old days.
Yeah. But it's still going on. It's not just the old days.
Well,
there are still people who are levitating things and producing ectoplasm and other such things.
I want to know these people.
Yes. Well, you know, part of the problem is that they've kind of gone underground.
Mm-hmm.
They've had such bad experiences with researchers or pseudo-researchers who have come and actually attacked some people. You know, if a medium is in a trance and producing ectoplasm, et cetera, it's very dangerous to even shine a bright light on the person, let alone touch them.
Right.
And the reports about Helen Duncan were that, you know, that contributed to her death, that the police or whatever raided her, you know, and thinking that an ectoplasmic apparition was a person, jumped on it, you know, and wound up on her, and she had a burn mark across her body, and, you know, it's dangerous. So spiritualist groups, who are primarily the people who are sponsoring these things and doing these things, will not allow anybody into any of the seances unless they are positive that these people are serious about it and, you know, are not going to give them any grief. So it's very difficult to find. The other thing is that most people ignore this because they just think it's bunk. It's got such a bad reputation. Some of it deserved because of the frauds that piled into the act. You know, during the heyday of spiritual mediumship, you had people like Daniel Dunglass Hume, who were supported royally by royals, by kings and queens and heads of state, you know.
Well, D.D. Hume, for example, was famous for walking out of windows and into others.
Well, there was an incident. I didn't put it in my book because I was dealing primarily with the seance, but there was an incident, very well recorded and verified, that he did actually float out a window and back into another one. I mean, he did all sorts of weird things. He could elongate himself, in other words, make himself taller. He could levitate himself and was seen doing that not only by hundreds of lay people, but by scientists who, you know, were watching under the table, over the table, whatever, especially Sir William Crookes, the great physicist, chemist, whatever. He could do all these things and never, ever found to be fraudulent. And was verified by Crookes and by others.
And the day of them being sponsored by royalty and just throngs of people
it was,
is over.
It was kind of an interesting phenomenon because he didn't work. People would take him into their homes, and he would live, you know, kind of off people, and for that he would give seances, you know, in their homes or whatever. And that's the way he actually lived, and people would give him gifts, you know, they'd give him, I guess, gold snuff boxes or things like that. But this whole concept of the body and mind being able to alter gravity, I mean, Hume would levitate tables, heavy mahogany tables that would sit 12 to 14 banquet tables. And this is a very slight man who had tuberculosis. He did not go behind a curtain or anything. He sat in a chair in the room in full view of everybody. The rooms were well lit. It wasn't a dark room. And tables, let's say, would levitate and tilt. Everything on the table would stay on the table. Glass, dinnerware, whatever, would not slide off the table. It would be that he was actually altering the gravitational field. And one interesting observation, I have an illustration in the book of it, by an Austrian noblewoman who was attending one of his seances, or attended several. But she noticed that there was a candlestick on a table that levitated. And she said the table tilted, the candlestick tilted, the candle tilted, and the flame tilted.
Wow.
Now, that kind of blows your mind because you think of flames, of course, always going up, you know. But if he could tilt things that way, and even the flame tilts, that means he's altering molecular structure of the area, the gravitational field in that particular area, whatever it is. But if this is so, and we have every reason to believe it is because there were so many witnesses and it's been verified by so many people, then physics has to change the way they're looking at things. There are things that we haven't found out about and things that the human organism can do. People can do these things.
Unfortunately.
And it's not, you know, you have the groups like the famous PsyCop group or all these, I call them pseudo-skeptics, because they're just debunkers, you know, and they will give you all sorts of excuses. But a book just came out recently on Hume, that's a, publicized somebody else's book, that was written by someone I know who is...
Well, if it's a friend of yours, I'll run out and buy it.
But he's a magician as well as a researcher. And I remember at one conference he gave a report about Hume. It was like taking the National Enquirer of their day, you know, and kind of reporting on Hume with that kind of information. And, of course, everybody jumped all over him. And I remember saying to him, look, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater, which is a favorite phrase of mine. And lo and behold, several years later, he comes out with a book on Hume saying he can't find anything wrong that this guy was doing. In other words, he has no explanation for this as far as magical terms or anything.
There's one thing I really want to ask you about, and I don't know if it's in your book directly or not, but you're the closest person to an expert on this kind of stuff that I've ever talked to, so I got to get it in. I remember, there's a couple things I remember when I was a kid, and I'm turning 40, so this is a long, 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 long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things was on PBS back then, they would occasionally show these interesting little vignettes about the supernatural. And that's pretty much what, you know, helped cement my interest.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things was a clip. It was very short. It was of a medium who looked like she was exerting herself greatly, okay, which
mm-hmm.
actually unfortunately describes several mediums of the era.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a video. It was, you know, obviously very early video technology. They had put a laser, the equivalent of a laser, inside of a vacuum
mm-hmm.
under glass. So they had this tube with a laser in it, in this tube that was in a vacuum, and then they put a huge light, or not huge, but they put a bell jar over it
mm-hmm.
so that there were a couple of layers to get to that laser beam. They
mm-hmm.
the scientists around the table all said it is absolutely completely impossible
mm-hmm.
to bend that laser beam.
And she deflected it.
She did it. I don't know who it was, and
yeah,
I can think of...
It's one of two people, and at the moment my memory is going. It was either Nina Kulagina, the Russian, or Olga Warrell, who was actually of Russian parentage, but she was an American healer. Those two women lent themselves unstintingly to scientific research. I know Warrell affected a cloud chamber, as well as other things. She's the one that affected the rye plants from 200 miles away and things like that. The deflection of the laser beam, I think, was Nina Kulagina, and I do have a chapter on her in my book.
Hey, good call, Doug.
Sorry?
Good call on that one,
good
Doug.
Call. Yeah, because I knew that you would know.
Yes.
Or
now,
at least
I call Nina Kulagina a secular medium because there's no implication of spirits or anything like that in what she did. And she and Ted Serios, you know, with the films, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
They're using their own abilities, their own living energies. And Kulagina would, the clue that you gave me there was great effort.
Yeah.
She would expend tremendous effort to do these things. Her blood pressure would go sky high, her heart rate, Serios too, the same thing. And if they worked her too much, if she did too much, she would have to go to bed for days. She would be actually blind. She couldn't see. I mean, it's very depleting to the body. But she, and she probably overdid it. She died fairly young. And there are many people that felt that, you know, she just, they used her so much that she,
wore herself out.
She burned out.
Yeah.
Sure. But that's probably who it was. I mean, because they filmed her. In fact, Montague Ullman, who was one of the, I have to get back to my own book.
Yes, he was
one of the Bindeloff boys who's involved in this. But Montague Ullman, because of his experience with the Bindeloff group, went into parapsychology and did some very famous and important work at the Maimonides Dream Laboratory. But he went over to Russia to observe Kulagina and brought back films of her levitating ping pong ball and doing other things. So there was a lot of, probably around the time that you were growing up, there was a lot written about her. There was a book by about the psychic discoveries behind the Iron Curtain, and she was part of that, and it was a big...
I have a book called that. I should probably dig that
out.
Yeah,
that's the Ostrander or something.
Yeah, book. I should dig that out and look for a chapter on her. And I should also buy the...
Yeah, don't... I wouldn't bother, really, with that book. That book had a lot of inaccuracies in it, and it's kind of out of date.
Well, I remember reading it a long, long time ago, and I remember thinking... pretty much exactly that. But it's told more of a story. We went here and we met up with this person who said this and that. And we went there and we met up with it. And I'm like, this is
yeah,
a very...
I have colleagues and friends who went and saw Kulagina and spoke with her and worked with her, et cetera. So, I mean, she was legitimate. There were some accusations that she had cheated with string or something at one time, but a lot of the movements that she did were away from her, not toward her, and stopped the frog's heart. That caused a lot of trouble. It was an excised heart that was an addition or that kind of thing.
She stopped, right. She stopped a frog's heart?
Well, you know, they can excise a heart, take it out of a frog or something and put it in a solution and keep it beating with electricity, whatever.
Yeah,
and she was affecting it, and then they asked her to stop it, and she didn't. But it wasn't killing anything, the heart.
Right. It was already out of the frog.
Yeah, it was already like,
right,
yeah.
Right. And, well, but it caused a big foo-for-all because, you know, people were... talking about thinking that, you know, some psychic could stop your heart or something like that.
Oh, I remember the big flap that caused.
Yeah, so it was quite a flap.
But
Montague Ullman, as I said, is an important name because he was the third or fourth boy to join the Bindelof group. Let me tell you a little bit about the Dr. Bindelof group because this is an important story that
First, I want to know what drew you to it. How did you hear about the group? And then let's talk about them.
Well, I was always interested, as you said before, in this area. And in the early 1970s, I took a course at the New School in what he called paramechanics, which was physical phenomena, by a man named Gilbert Rohler. Mm-hmm. Gil was... he was an artist. He was a film producer at that time. He did all sorts of things. He was a musician. He played the piano. He did photography. He was a real Renaissance man and just a wonderful guy. And in his class, I talk about in the book how we did some experiments with him with a radio with my ex-husband who had some psychic ability and psychokinetic ability. And after I had known Gil for a long time, he never mentioned in the class, he talked a little bit about how he got into the field. He was the center of poltergeist activity as a kid.
Ooh.
And yes, very interesting things, you know, including some of the things that happened later on in the seances. For instance, his mother, who was a very temperamental Broadway star, she was, you know, in operettas. She created the role of Victor Herbert's Eileen. She was quite a beautiful woman with a gorgeous voice, and she was also quite psychic and had an enormous library of these famous scientists of the day who were studying all these people. So Gil used to read about these things, but she and her husband, who's Gil's stepfather, used to get into these violent arguments, and Gil would get very panicky. But anyway, things would be thrown around the apartment. They would hear her hairpins being thrown and things like that. One time there was a commotion in a cabinet, and when Gil went to open the door, he thought it was a cat had gotten caught in the cabinet or something. It was his electric train that he found in there that had been just torn to pieces. Now that takes a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot of energy.
Yeah,
metal Lionel train being torn all apart, you know.
Well, those things back in the day, those things were heavy, dude.
And metal
school Lionel train.
Yeah,
you can use those things as a blunt instrument, dude.
Yeah.
And one time they came back from eating out or something and crayoned on the walls in like 4 feet high letters were the words go, go. And, you know, like, get out.
Gosh.
So at one time when she had a fight with her husband, she took Gil, and they went, to stay with some people she knew. And while they were there, they decided to have a seance, because she used to do that with the Dolly sisters. Evidently, they always did seances. And this was Gil's first seance. And after they sat down and were quiet for a while, the curtain started to blow from the windows as though the windows were open. They weren't. And furniture started to move across the floor and kind of scared the people when they stopped.
Oh, wow.
So when he was a teenager then, he met another boy named Lenny and told him about what he knew. And Lenny started reading. They were very precocious boys. And so they started experimenting with a bridge table. And just the two of them first, and they got movement and tilting and things like that. And then they invited a third boy, Larry, who's still alive and lives in California. He's 90 years old. And they got levitation of the table, or, amongst other things, and wraps. And little by little, they formed a group. And the entity that they were supposedly communicating with identified himself as a Dr. Bindeloff, who said he wanted to come and heal people. And they produced all sorts of amazing phenomena, a lot of the same stuff that the classics had done, also photography. On the cover, if anybody's onto my website, they'll see the cover of the book, which has a picture of Dr. Bindeloff, a photograph. Now, this is not an ordinary photograph. This is what we might call a thoughtograph or a spirit photograph. They used to get messages from Dr. Bindeloff where a pencil, they put a foolscap paper, you know, on the lower shelf of this little table that they were now using, which was a nightstand kind of thing, with a pencil. And little by little, they started getting messages where the pencil would pick itself up and write. Write messages, sometimes one-word answers to a spontaneous question, sometimes long, full-page illustrated messages, and they asked if they could get his photograph. Gil had used to use, you know, the old cameras that had the glass emulsion-covered plates, and in a message, he gave them instructions that in a dark room, they would point the camera toward at the center of the table, blank table, take off the cap for a certain number of seconds, put it back on, and develop the plate. And the picture that they got, this three-quarter portrait, is the picture that came out. Yes, it's quite remarkable. And I know.
Is that why you also looked into Ted Serios, or did you already?
Well, that's why I included a chapter. I mean, I had known about Ted Serios, and I was friendly with Dr. Jewel Eisenblatt, who was a wonderful man, who was the man who studied and wrote about Ted. And so I had a lot of firsthand information on that as well. But I included a chapter in the book on Ted Serios. What I tried to do was to show the things that the Bindeloff group did, which had never really been written for the public before. In fact, I just got a wonderful review from the British SPR journal, Guy Lyon Playfair, gave me a wonderful review, and I thanked him for it, and on an email he said thank me for getting it out to the public, so I was very gratified about that.
Well, I have to agree with him, and I just want to make one little aside.
Sure.
Ted Serios actually came up in a conversation probably about a month ago. And
he died recently.
Yes, but I couldn't remember his name when I was talking about him.
That's happening. I do that all the time.
So whoever I was talking to,
sorry,
we were talking about a fellow who would be able to go up and he would grab a camera. And these were not cameras that he prepared. These are cameras that people would bring to him on the street.
Yeah, and lots of time, most of the time, actually, he wouldn't be allowed to touch the camera.
And then
were doing experiments with him.
And then a lot of times they wouldn't even let him do that. But his you know, the film clip that I saw, again, this was way back on like PBS days.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He grabbed a video camera and he created the scene of a park-like setting or something on the film, and they're like,
I don't remember, I don't think so. What he did do, and it's in one of the journals of the American Society for Psychic Research, you can see the pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
They were working at a university, and he wasn't getting anything. You know, he had to drink in order to loosen up enough.
Yeah.
And he'd be three sheets to the wind most of the time. What they got was, it was like a train, but going like on the side of the video. In other words, not right across the video, but like along the side of it.
Right.
I think what you might be thinking of is something they did in England that Jewel had told me about, Jewel Eisenberg, that he wandered over. They weren't getting anything. They were just talking. And Ted wandered over to the camera, and you could see his eye coming towards the camera. And then upside down across the top went a double-decker bus.
I wonder if that was it, but I see now here's something. Now, remember, I'm going back years and years.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was in Chicago.
Yes, that's where he lived.
Okay.
He was a bellhop. And as a matter of fact, Kurt Fuller, who used to publish Fate magazine,
mm-hmm.
had written to Jules Eisenbud and told him about Ted Serios. And Eisenbud said, you know, first of all, he was busy, he wasn't interested, and he threw the letter away. And he figured, well, if this guy's so good, somebody else will have, you know.
Right.
And,
I would have heard of him by now. Right. That's what
right.
I say a lot.
And, of course,
yeah.
that wasn't the case. And I think Kurt tried a couple of times, and finally Jules was going to, he was flying to New York from Denver, where he then lived. And he said, okay, he would stop by on the way back to Denver in Chicago and meet him, and that's how it got started.
Interesting. So my memory is just bits and pieces. I'll reconstruct mm-hmm. it with information, obviously in your book.
But why I put the chapter in the book was because of the photography that they did, and I'm making a comparison because if you look at the picture of Dr. Bindeloff, there are certain characteristics that are characteristic of these mental photos. There's a graininess and a fuzziness, that mm-hmm. Quality that's in them. And so that's why I included the chapter, and I'm thankful for Eric Eisenbud for the permission to do that.
This entire conversation so far has been, first of all, I don't actually have goosebumps, but I can feel my skin like in a pre-goosebump stage, because this is my topic. This is something that I love to talk about, and I don't get to talk about enough. So I do want to remind people real quick. It's www.rspiritsreal.com, A-R-E, Spirits, Real, R-E-A-L, all run together, no spaces.com. And this is personally interesting to me, and I just want to make that appeal to people that physical phenomena such as this I just, when I go to bed at night, when I wake up in the morning, I think, you know, that it must still be going on, and evidently, and thank heavens we're talking to you, because now we find out it is, and it's still an important part of the psychic phenomena realm that I think needs to be studied more and written about more, which is why I'm very excited about your book, The Spirit of Dr. Bindeloff.
Mm-hmm.
So these boys get together, and they create this thing that, now, first of all, it would be bittersweet, I think. On the one hand, I find it so exciting that I would sort of love to be able to do this stuff, you know, get together with a few of my friends and you know, lay hands on a table and have it walk around the room. And I've heard the stories. My mom would tell stories for endless, countless hours of
mm-hmm.
when her and the other, you know, women would get together once in a great while, and they would do the table tipping, and they'd get answers, mm-hmm. and it was cute. And then, so I've heard those stories, and I read all I can about, you know, the old mm-hmm. spiritualism movement and the apportations that would happen, and these mm-hmm. things that scientists say are impossible. You know, the bending of a laser beam. You can't
do it. Well, it depends on the scientist.
Well, that's true. but you can't
do it.
And
there is a tremendous amount of prejudice.
Yes.
A lot of it is fear.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of it is that, well, there were so many fakes that jumped on the bandwagon.
That is true.
They painted everybody with the same brush. And, you know, it just has gotten a bad rap.
It has. And
also, it boggles the mind. You know, Renee Haynes used the term, which I love, the boggle threshold. That we all have a boggle threshold. Now, mine is pretty high, but there are still some things that that boggle my mind. For instance, we know of mediums. Helen Duncan was one of the other people that Crook studied, Florey Fox, whatever, who produced not only phantoms that people could see, but phantoms that would walk and talk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that
oh,
really
yeah.
boggles the mind. The Katie King thing, I have a chapter on that William Crook studied. she would, the medium would be taped, tied up in a chair in a curtained off room that had electronic kind of surveillance of the time. And coming through the curtains there would be this white-robed, idealized version of the medium. In other words, the phantom looked like the medium, but she was taller, she had prettier hair, she had long fingernails where the medium had her fingers off.
Like where the medium would have wanted to have been
exactly.
elegant. Yeah.
And she would walk amongst the observers, the scientists who were there. A physician one time was taking her pulse. He could feel a pulse. And then he pushed his thumb further and made a hole in the wrist.
Ooh.
Now, I mean, this is, you know, and she would walk, and one time she said, oh, my medium is getting weak, and she started to dissolve in front of them.
Wow.
So that her head was talking to them from the floor. I mean, it's kind of, now this even boggles my threshold, you know. However, we have to look at the verification. We have to look at who was there, some of the top scientists of the times, and their reports on this, primarily Sir William Crookes. And
yes.
Crookes, of course, didn't get his knighthood for many, many years because of his involvement with it. And the same people who, when they heard he was going to study these physical mediums, said, oh, he's the man to do it. You know, he's got the acumen and blah, blah, blah. And then when he came out with his report on Hume and then on this the Katie King case, they smeared him like mad, just as they do today.
The more things change.
Affair with her. I mean, you know, it was awful.
Yeah, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
He maintained that he was not taking anything back, and it was all as he had said.
Amazing. So these kids get together at the time. They're young,
mm-hmm.
and they're experimenting with all this stuff. And they actually do you think that Dr. Bindeloff was an actual spirit, or perhaps a projection? Because what I'm going with this is the experiments in Toronto,
the
Philip experiment,
yeah, where they made up the
they ghost. Made up the ghost. But this was a ghost that
okay.
came.
Okay, what I try to do is to allow the reader to make up his or her mind.
Okay.
In the Bindeloff group itself, Larry, who I mentioned before, who lives in La Jolla. Has carried the Bindeloff picture around with him all these years. He's 90 years old now. He's from the 1930s. He believes that Dr. Bindeloff was what he said he was and has guided him through his life, etc. Dr. Ullman believes that he was conjured up out of their unconscious and was like a father figure because they were all fellows who either didn't have a father or whose father was away from home or either emotionally or physically absent. Gill didn't quite know what to believe. I think he was more in Ullman's camp where he thought that they had conjured up Dr. Bindeloff. But Larry was the one who was the true believer. My own bias is that these are not spirits. These are living energies, and that we really need to look at these things and need to study them and try to wipe away all the prejudice against it so that scientists will really look at this stuff. That's why I call it an enigma at this point. It is a mystery, and there's a lot that we don't know, but there's so much that we could learn if we would only really look at this stuff and understand that these things are real.
I'm finding first of all, I find that to be absolutely true. There's not enough going on, at least because you know the state of popular media. You've probably got a TV and you've got the internet and you're on this show. You know this
and
is
you
a,
have biases.
A
and
new media show.
One of the most biased. I mean, I read it every day. You know, but when it comes to anything to do with psychic abilities or everything, they are completely biased against it and print disparaging things. Even the other day, Dr. Ian Stevenson died, and they had to interject. They always have to have somebody from the pseudo-skeptics putting their two cents in and, you know, putting this stuff down. And it's really a shame because they're really doing an injustice to the people.
Mm-hmm. And when there is a new crop of media. There's this kind of show which we're on. Mm-hmm. We're on, you know, hundreds.
And thank
or
goodness
so.
For you.
Little stations all throughout, you know, the world, but we're also, you know, podcasted and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're reaching people, but even we don't talk enough about this stuff. This is a side of exactly what we're running around trying to study that
mm-hmm.
we don't talk about even enough amongst ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I don't know if this will be a surprise or not, but it's actually sort of actively discouraged because of the Ouija board. That's why this kind of stuff
yes.
is actively
discouraged.
And
because of superstition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Ouija board is nothing more than a nice way of tapping into your unconscious. It has nothing to do with spirits, evil or otherwise. And it's a good way to find out what's going on in your head. The stuff that comes out is the same kind of stuff that comes out in your dreams. You know, it's all in the unconscious. If we understood the unconscious of the subconscious, we would understand almost everything because
right.
that's where all of this stuff lies.
And that's where all of it can be tapped into. And that's what I've really, you know, because I study Edgar Cayce a lot. That's one of my favorite psychics.
Mm-hmm.
And he said pretty much he has backed up a lot of this phenomena. He says that, for example, instead of doing the automatic writing, trying to contact with an external spirit, go into yourself.
Right.
That's where you need to do your automatic writing. He also
said
that's
really what's going on when you do any of this.
Right.
You're really, you know, bringing up a lot of things from inside you. And even the Bindelof thing, my feeling is that, yes, they were kind of creating this man who was a father figure who would be a guide to them and who would carry out their wishes as far as healing people. They did healings, you know,
mm-hmm.
they had parents coming in or other people coming in to have ailments healed by Dr. Bindelof, you know, it was kind of all these altruistic feelings that were coming out. But as the group then started to grow apart, women started to come into to play. There was one gal that was sitting, and she got involved with one of the fellows, and the other fellows were jealous or whatever. And the group started then to fall apart, and they wanted to go on with their lives and go to school and all this, you know. And then the manifestations started to become a little bit more violent. You know, papers would be thrown or a pencil would be thrown across the room, things like that. So I think it was a reflection of what was going on in their collective psyche.
Did this case, did this stuff, wherever they
wrong.
where where they have the studio or where they would perform the stuff, could they do it pretty much anywhere? Where were they based?
Well, they were kids when they started. I mean, they were 15 or 16. So when Gil and Lenny started, they started in Lenny's apartment. They were a little afraid to go to Gil's apartment because there were still the bad feelings about the poltergeist activities when he was a kid.
Right.
But that's where they did wind up, and they were working in Gil's bedroom, which was a small room, and they were crammed in. You'd have, you know, six or eight teenagers crammed into this small space. It's kind of interesting because, you know, this is in New York.
Right.
And in New York City, you can never make the room pitch dark. So there was always some light. They could always see each other's outlines. Their chairs were, like Howard, one of the fellows said, he was talking about Dr. Bindelof touching him on the head. And he said the hands came from behind. His chair was just practically against the wall. He said nobody could have gotten behind him. Plus, if anybody had stood up, they would all feel it and all see it because it wasn't that dark, and they always held each other's fingers and stepped on each other's feet. So, you know, it was definitely, you know, this ectoplasmic fingers or whatever behind his head, massaging his head from behind.
Did they believe that any of this came from a higher power or?
Well, I think at the time they probably did, and I think that made it even more potent. And I have a chapter on that, on belief and how it helps. Because if you believe that this is not you doing it, it's the spirits doing it, well, the sky's the limit. They can do anything.
Right.
If you think that it's yourself doing it, you become inhibited. What Kenneth Batchelder called ownership resistance, etc. So it helps if you believe that these are spirits. And I think you talked about EVP before. I think that's a lot of it, that people believe they're communicating. I think, frankly, that most of the EVP is psychokinetic.
And fortunately, there are people studying just that.
Well, not unfortunately. I have colleagues who are very intelligent, well-educated people who firmly believe that they are contacting spirits.
Right.
You know, it has nothing to do, the belief in the afterlife cannot be proven and it cannot be disproven. And it comes down to a matter of what you believe.
Are we doomed to think that forever? I mean, because are we never going to actually, while we're still physically inhabiting bodies, not know? I mean, is that one of the, like, curses that we have, that we have to go through life just really wondering all the time? I wonder. But because,
well, everybody loves a mystery.
Yes, they do, especially me. When did they ever successfully apport anything? Did anything appear? Because here's why I ask. I read a book called, like, La Treaty de Parapsychologie or something like that. Of course, I didn't read it in French. I read the English translation. I understood maybe 5% of the book. But one of the things that they talk about repeatedly, and they talk about DDU, is apportation.
I don't think that there were any apports at the seances that these particular people had. Gil, later on in life, I know one time when I knew him, you know, because long after the seances at least the Bindeloff group had stopped, he was the only one in the group who later went on and had seances with other people that produced something.
Okay.
Never as strong as the Bindeloff group, though. But I remember one time Gil was going to a meeting of some sort, and he had this letter, and he said he put it in his briefcase and went down to the meeting, which was downtown. He lived uptown. And when he got to the meeting and things started to unfold, he realized that the letter would actually be detrimental to him. When he opened the briefcase and looked for it, it was gone. Now, he said he put it in there, you know. And I said to him, because when he came home, he found it back, you know, in the apartment. And I said, well, Gil, couldn't it be that you just, you know, absentmindedly? He said, no, I put it in purposely and closed it to bring it with me. So, and I've heard of, you know, other people that I know, things have happened like that, where something dematerializes and then rematerializes, you know. And in this case, there was an emotional component, which is very important, saying, oh, God, you know, this is going to hurt me if they see this. And the thing disappears and he finds it back home.
That's pretty advantageous in that instance. Usually,
yeah.
Though, not modern ones are usually associated with tricksters, you know. My keys are missing. I looked everywhere, and then they're hanging on the hook.
The thing is, you know, just talk about levitation, for instance.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when Siegfried and Roy were practicing in Las Vegas, you could go and see them levitate magnificently. Of course, they were on their turf, on their stage. They had thousands of dollars of machinery behind them.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is a trick, and they can levitate by using these tricks. However, if you're on your turf, you're at your room, a strange room, and a person comes in and levitates in front of your eyes, then that's something else.
Right.
So all these, not all these, but a lot of these phenomena can be done by trick photography. They can be done by magicians, by trickery. But it's the real stuff. And a lot of it, you know, they say they can. I mean, the most famous of the pseudo-skeptics, a magician, I don't want to mention his name, you know, will claim to do things. but he never does them. For instance, we talked about Ted Serios. He claimed that he could do the same thing that Serios did under the same conditions. However, he never did. And he was invited by Jule Eisenberg to do it, and he never did. However, just saying that he did, everybody thinks that he did.
That is interesting, the power
of sight of mouth.
And you know, we did indeed get to talk to, we've talked to, although Uri Geller is not sleight of mouth. He actually, I heard stories when he was hanging around, he was doing shows in, I think, Philadelphia, and they would be carried nationally. This is talking decades ago.
Yeah.
So I don't think anything's actually done in Philadelphia anymore. But,
I know. I was just there.
Yeah. But he did these things, and I swear I heard, you know, my mom and her friends were talking about seeing that morning show that he was on, and some of them did claim that they'd go into the kitchen and they have a bent spoon.
When we had Uri on the show here, for example, we had people email us back. I mean, during the show, because we tried some experiments around the air here. This is like a year and a half ago. We had him on the show, and literally, I mean, we had emails from people. We had one email, as a matter of fact, a gentleman emailed and said, "I have a laptop started working again." He's like, "This thing was kaput. It didn't even work anymore."
And it started working.
Now, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, computers are very
long. Felt that Geller's importance at that time was not so much even his own abilities, but that so many other people came out of the woodwork and was showing that they had the ability as well.
But who doesn't?
You had all these mini Gellers, as they used to call them. I think, you know, there's been accusations. In fact, when I was writing book reviews for Fate magazine, I kind of provoked him because I wanted to get a little rise out of him and saying that, I could see that, you know, he was legitimate, but that he probably cheated in certain cases. I mean, because a psychic isn't always on. And if you've got thousands of people who've paid money to come and see you and you're not on that night, you've got to do something, you know.
Ooh.
And he wrote a letter to the magazine very indignant that he had never, resorted to that. I don't know if that's true or not. I do believe that he is definitely talented in psychokinetics. Stories like, I knew a woman who was a publisher who knew him, and I think it was at Puharch's house when he was there, but I'm not sure. It could have been at her own house. But anyway, they were sitting around the table, and he was sitting with his back toward a sideboard or a piece of furniture, and there was a bowl with, I don't know, I thought it was potatoes, but it might have been apples or something. Anyway, one of them just, you know, raised up and flew off and landed on the floor or something.
God.
And that's quite common with people who have poltergeist activities around them. You know, where things will, especially if they're a little agitated or angry. I know I was called in. I live on Staten Island, and I was called in on a case one time of a young man and his wife, and they were very upset because there were certain things happening in the house that they couldn't explain, and they were going through, I think, some kind of an emotional thing at the time. They were about to adopt a child, and I think there were, you know, issues. And when I went to talk to this young man, he said he had a twin brother, and his twin brother wouldn't believe him that these things were happening, was poo-pooing. And he was sitting on a hassock, and the TV was behind him, and on the TV was a copy of the TV guide, and his brother was sitting across from him on a couch. And I think when he got annoyed that his brother wasn't believing him, he said all of a sudden he saw something move, and over his head comes the TV guide, picked itself up, rose over his head, and landed on the floor between them. And his brother said, "I believe." So, I mean, these things do happen spontaneously lots of times.
Of course,
controlling them, that's the trick.
Yeah, that's the hard part. Did the Bindeloff group, did they ever have spontaneous psychokinesis happen or physical manifestation?
Yes, just like the Philip group outside the seance room.
Wow.
The watch crystals used to crack. There's a whole, there we have about the disappearing in the reports. Gil and Larry used to hang around together all the time, and they got a job working for a label company where these people would make labels, and then they would have to take the orders and deliver them to Macy's and Gimbel's and the other places. And when the seances were on, they started getting complaints from, let's say, Macy's would say, hey, you sent me five Macy's labels and five Gimbel's labels. So they thought, well, they had just made a mistake. So they were very careful about putting the right labels in the right envelopes and delivering them, and they would still get switched. So there were things
nuts
that
right
happened.
There too.
Yeah, I write about a couple more things that probably had to do. In fact, one was with Larry's false teeth, which is a very funny story. That's in the book.
I so want to read this. It did when you worked on the book. First of all, how long did it take?
Well, the book went through many incarnations because it started out as an academic work. I had gotten the materials from Dr. Ullman. Dr. Ullman was very reluctant to have this book published. He eventually wrote it up for a small in-house kind of publication when he knew that I was going to do this. But at any rate, it was supposed to be more of an academic work, and I couldn't sell it. And then I, you know, changed it and revised it, and I put it aside and kind of just dropped the whole thing. And then Gil and Larry were after me to do it again and other people. And so it took a number of years. So it went on for, I don't know, 15 years maybe from started until I got it published.
Well, this is actually a very fortuitous time to get it out here because I go to these conferences throughout the year, and we're scheduled for what, a dozen of them this year. We go to conferences, and not that we're ever looking for anything to talk about, because we always have something to talk about. I think I would like to work this kind of stuff in to our discussions and see what people are, because I talk to people who go on cases. They go into people's homes. They do these things, and I'd like to try and get a gauge of how much the old is meeting the new.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now we're only talking about the new. You know, mental. Everything's about mental mediumship. Everything.
And the EVP stuff.
Yeah, and EVP.
Yeah.
And oh, you know what's interesting? I wrote this down earlier while you were talking, and you had said one thing, and then we've got to wrap up, unfortunately.
Oh, unfortunately.
But You had said that it was the effects were strongest with the group, and that when Gil went off and did it with other groups, he got the effects, but they were much weaker. They weren't they weren't like to the quality of with the original group. And you know what's interesting? There's a parallel. There's a not new, but there's a field of research related to EVP. It was semi-related to EVP called ITC. Instrumental transcommunication.
Yes.
And that's exactly what we hear out of them. That when you work with a close-knit group, you'll get
better results.
You'll get the results.
If you want to start your own sitter group, I have a chapter on how to do that. That's the important thing. It's the harmony in the group itself.
This is an echo of ITC.
Exactly.
I wonder if the old
but
is new
related.
Again.
It's all related.
Is the old new again? That's what I wonder. Your book, the Spirit of Dr. Bindeloff, I think it's going to revamp my 2007, Rosemary.
I hope you get it. You can order it right through my website. There's a thing you can click on to buy from Amazon.com.
Oh, I'm ordering it tonight. I want it with me for my trip in 2 weeks. When, or maybe tomorrow morning, depending. But do you go on the lecture circuit? Do you go to?
Well, I haven't. My daughter was very ill for the past 2 years.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
She passed away this past December.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear about that.
I'm hoping to do more speaking and get more into publicizing the book. I just really haven't been able to do it up until recently. So. I'm hoping to do more talks. How much I don't know. You know how much I can do, but I will try.
Well, we're hoping to cross paths. With
I really really hope we do because I would love to take you to lunch. And just,
oh, I would love it.
Yeah, with you. First. I'm telling you, as a matter of fact, I consciously did not take our 8:30 break.
We didn't do that,
and that's something that's very difficult for me because I have to struggle. When we take breaks, we play independent music.
Uh-huh.
And one of my passions is independent, people,
everything.
Independent everything, people doing their music or their DVDs and things like that, mm-hmm. and not signing to a major label or anything like that, but just trying to get it out there themselves.
Yeah.
And we help these people out here.
We help them out. And I didn't play one because I was so enraptured by your hour.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to both of you.
Thank you so much. Again,
keep in touch. You can contact me through my website.
Definitely. Hang on the line.
One more thing.
Your book is The Spirit of Dr. Bindeloff, of course, and your website is www.rspiritsreal.com. That's A-R-E spiritsreal, R-E-A-L.com. You can get the book through that. Remember, you guys, this is the old stuff. This is the stuff that fascinates me to no end.
Oh, yeah.
And
but it's still going on.
It's still going on.
It is.
This book is proof. And thank you, Rosemary, for doing
you,
it.
Sir.
Don't hang up.
Hang up for
don't
one
hang up.
I have one more second.
I do want to thank Rosemary Pilkington of OurSpiritsReal.com. I want to thank, of course, Bill Weiss for being patient with us. We're going to get him back on.
We're going to get him on. I think we might have licked our problems tonight in the middle of the show.
In just a couple of weeks, we'll have him back. We'll have him on. Lori, Catherine, and Dano.
Oh, thanks, guys.
GhostConnection.net. You guys.
See you in a couple weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And, of course, the illustrious Teddy Schuyler of Virginia is off to
Savannah, Georgia,
in a couple weeks. And hopefully she'll come back with a report on just how haunted she found Savannah, Georgia. Until next week.
Yes.
This has been Ghostly Talk, and I have been Doug.
I have been Scott L., and we'll see you guys next week.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
I need to go someplace where a man can think.
Become the media.